The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week...
It's now clear that there is a route that can secure a substantial and sustainable majority in this House for leaving the EU with a deal. Yeah, yeah.
The Brexit clock is ticking, but rather than deal with the tricky business of navigating a route for a compromise deal through Parliament, politicians opted to play fantasy Brexit instead. The Brady Amendment demands what Theresa May had previously said was impossible, the replacement of the Northern Irish backstop. So can May achieve the impossible? Also this week, Heather Stewart chats to historian Kevin O'Rourke about his new book, A Short History of Brexit. And we talk to Rajiv Sial about the first serving MP to be jailed in 28 years, Fiona Onisanya. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. At last, the Tory party have finally decided what Brexit it is that they want. Unfortunately, it's a fantasy. It's 2 years too late, and the EU have already said no. The Brady Amendment, which was passed on Tuesday, demands the replacement of the Northern Irish backstop with alternative arrangements. But 6 minutes after the vote was counted, Brussels reminded everyone that the withdrawal agreement is not open for renegotiation. Undaunted, May will need to go back to Brussels to demand the impossible. Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by my expert panel, The Guardian's Polly Toynbee and Martin Kettle, plus Arti Shankar from Open Europe. Polly, when May first lost the vote, some of the immediate reaction afterwards was that she was going to have to soften her deal, that she was going to have to reach out, you know, across the chamber, perhaps offer a customs union. But she's gone the other way. Why is that?
Well, she's given herself one last chance. I think she's a bit like Canute, sort of proving to her people that actually this isn't possible. So, all right, I'll go and do 2 weeks of negotiating to prove that I was right in the first place. And then she has to confront her own side and say, right, only a softer version could get through. I think it's a very tricky process, but she must know that she's on the mission from hell and she's not going to get anything from it.
Martin, she's a kind of Tory tribalist at heart, isn't she, Theresa May? And it's not quite natural for her, really, was it, to sort of pivot in the other direction?
Absolutely true. I mean, I think that she has consistently tried, ever since she became leader of the Tory party, to prove to the whole of the Tory party that she can be trusted with Brexit, having been an equivocal Remainer in 2016. So in that sense, she's still doing that. I mean, I think she's still trying to show the hard levers that they can trust her. I mean, we've gone way beyond that, however. And so one really worries, I think, that she has left it to a very, very late stage to try to do any kind of opening out to Labour, which has its own problems and it presents its own difficulties. So I actually think I'm not quite as complimentary as Polly's being to her cleverness on this. I think she's sort of running into the buffers at the moment, and I really do think that a crash is more likely than an amazing escape.
And we heard sort of breaking overnight just afterwards this idea of the Malthouse Compromise, that's named after the housing minister, Kit Malthouse, a rather unlikely player in all of this, but he, you know, is a Leaver, but someone sort of liked and respected on both sides, suggesting that that May replace the backstop with a kind of alternative technological arrangement in exchange for perhaps an extra year on the transition period. And if that doesn't happen, and this is the bit that I think Downing Street think is a lot more far-fetched, is that you would then instead have that three-year transition period, but then moved to WTO terms or to no deal, which means a sort of managed no deal that people like Penny Mordaunt have mentioned. And Arti, what do you make of this as an alternative option, and why has it managed to bring sort of the two sides together?
So I think as an alternative, it's been referred to as a unicorn, and I think largely that is what it is. I don't think it's there actually to serve as a substantive option for the UK to take. I think it was necessary, given that it served the context for MPs to vote in. It was almost kind of a prerequisite to get MPs on side to vote for this Brady Amendment that would send May back to look for something from the EU in the way of legally binding changes to the backstop. So I think it served as background from the Prime Minister's point of view. And I agree with Polly that part of her strategy here is probably kind of trying to show to her backbenchers that she is going as far as she possibly can, and any other kind of push on her will lead to a softer Brexit. But I think there's an other element to this, and the reason behind this Malthouse compromise, however far-fetched it might seem, and the Brady Amendment, which a lot of people have also referred to as far-fetched, is a signal as well to the EU. So let's not forget she suffered a historic defeat of 230. And the EU wasn't, I have sympathy with the EU in saying, you cannot prove to me that the only thing wrong with this deal is the backstop. I don't believe that a loss that big is purely to do with the backstop. There must be other things that are wrong with this deal that your parliamentarians simply cannot accept. But here, with the Brady Amendment and the Malthouse Compromise, she has attempted to say to the EU, no, I can show you there is a majority if you can give me something different on the backstop. This is my signal to you. And I think that is actually, rather than a substantive proposal, it's a symbolic one.
It's quite convincing, isn't it, Polly, that that's the only thing that's holding it back if you do get a majority in the House of Commons for it?
But, you know, the backstop isn't an only thing. It is the primary contradiction at the heart of all of this, that she has tried to get incompatible things. You know, you can't get all of the things she wants and keep an open border. And it's an internal contradiction in her demands. It's not Europe's fault. It's not Europe's contradiction. They have their rules, which we helped set. And we always knew that's where they stood. I cannot see how they can bend. I think she has to come back, confront her party and say, it's either no Brexit, or it's no deal, or it's a much softer deal than the one, go much closer to the Norway option, which she might just get through. I don't think she can get her own deal through. She might get a Norway option through, just. And I think that's her only hope.
Martin?
I think we're at a too late a stage for that. I think at this point, the most significant thing we're looking at is whether or not there's going to be an extension of Article 50, because that makes it a number of other things possible that I think are now becoming impossible because of the time constraints.
Interestingly, Jeremy Hunt on the radio this morning made it clear that extending the timescale will be necessary whatever now, and that's after the Institute for Government pointed out that there are eight enormous bills and hundreds of statutory instruments that simply physically could not be got through in time. So whatever happens, it seems, extension, longer or shorter, is inevitable.
I think that's true. I also just think that for May to get to a soft Brexit solution, which relies to some extent on Labour support and sacrifices the Tory right, is a huge political move that she has shown absolutely no sign of making so far. So if she was going to do that, then it's, I think, not something you can just do with a flick of the fingers and just say, OK, well, that was then, this is now. I don't think you can do that. So I think that's partly going to require time, but I just think it's hellishly difficult. I mean, just one thing on the backstop. The backstop is often talked about as though it's basically about Northern Ireland and the Republic. What it's basically about for the hardline leavers is about autonomous trade policy. It's not about Ireland. That's a secondary, inconvenient complication as far as they're concerned. And the real divide in the Tory party, I think, is between the autonomous trade fanatics who have constructed this as what Brexit is all about for them, completely undiscussed in 2016, by the way, and the business-friendly pragmatists who say, we have got to maintain some form of effective trading relationship with Europe throughout the transition period and beyond.
You mean, you both mentioned the possible extension to Article 50, but the House of Commons rejected that this week. They didn't vote for an amendment by Yvette Cooper, which would sort of pave the way for actual legislation which would have delayed a no-deal Brexit. Can it still happen, though? Do you think it's possible?
Yes, I think what we saw, Richard Harrington, the business minister, has said he'll give her one more go, two more weeks, and then and it's an amazing thing for a minister to say without being sacked, and then he will make sure that he votes for any and anything that extends the date, that stops a no deal. And the question is, how many Tories there are like him? You know, will the Amber Rudds, Greg Clarks, Philip Hammonds really resign rather than allow a no deal? Possibly. It depends on whether they think they've got the numbers. They need another 16 of Tories who haven't rebelled yet? Have they got that many? They're looking across with alarm at Labour's 25 rebels who have undermined the position drastically. They've done serious damage. And, you know, if the Labour vote isn't there, then the Tory vote won't be there either, and that's really dangerous.
Artie, what will Brussels be making of all of this? And do you think if there is a card to play, if there is a possibility of a sunset clause for the backstop or some sort of unilateral exit mechanism, is it the time to play that card now?
So I think that's the key question. What the EU will need in order to offer any sort of concession, it need not be completely reopening the withdrawal agreement and looking at the backstop. It could be something that goes alongside the agreement. I mean, this has been discussed a number of times. But before they can make that compromise, I think they need evidence that this will deliver a majority. And so there is some suggestion that what we saw with the vote on Tuesday was that the Prime Minister does have a stable majority for her deal if there are changes to the backstop. There is some truth to that, given the parliamentary arithmetic now, that this is probably what we see as a stable majority. But equally, the EU understands UK politics to a certain extent. They recognise that at least 20 ERG members are probably not going to vote for whatever is brought back from the UK. So it's not necessarily a given that if they concede now, we are on our way to a deal. And that is probably
what's the most they could concede, do you think?
So I think one of the things that has been discussed before is this sort of legal instrument that accompanies the withdrawal agreement. It doesn't mean reopening the whole text and discussing everything again. But what I think is necessary is a further legal assurance that this must be temporary. It's not enough for the EU to say, I think we've recognised now, that it's intended to be short, it's intended to be temporary. I think they would have to offer a statement, a letter that sort of said, right, well, we recognise that this backstop is predicated on Article 50. We have said a number of times Article 50 cannot form the basis of a permanent relationship. Therefore, this cannot be a permanent relationship, where the backstop cannot form a permanent arrangement. We recognise that. The Attorney General could then point to that and say to Conservative MPs, look, the EU itself has recognised this cannot be permanent. And what does temporary mean in general international law? I mean, we've heard Brexiteers talk time and time again about GATS 24. Okay, it's not useful in the way I think that they're suggesting, but it's useful in the international law under that article suggests that an interim relationship should be no longer than 10 years. Now, if we insert that and we say international law suggests that a temporary relationship, as you're suggesting, should only be for X amount of time, we get a little bit further down the road, I think, to offering some protection to those who are concerned that this is a trap in speech box.
But Brexiteers were pretty clear, and it sort of becomes something that's not actually based in its technical meaning, but just on the symbolic meaning of needing to hear the Prime Minister say from the dispatch box that what she intends to do is reopen the physical text of the withdrawal agreement. So take a red pen to it, rip some pages out, whatever you like, but they want to see her change that agreement, not just anything else. And Jacob Rees-Mogg sort of effectively made her say that on the floor of the House. Is that something that the EU might sort of hold back right to the end?
Well, I think we've set ourselves up for a bit of trouble. It's very difficult to see how the UK is going to start ripping pages out of this agreement. It can add things, I think. And if she needs a symbolic victory, it might be that she inserts something that says, that's not too much for the EU to give away, that says the way in which we function, the UK unilaterally accepts that when it makes a decision in the Joint Committee, for instance, on whether new laws apply to Northern Ireland, we are going to first ask the Northern Ireland institutions. It's been referred to as a Stormont lock. The EU doesn't actually have to concede anything. That's a UK unilateral commitment that it's making. But let's insert it in the text. That would essentially be a kind of a symbolic thing that you can point to that says we made them reopen it, we made them change something. It's probably not going to be with absolutely no cost. So we have to think about whether or not this is the most useful strategy to go down. But certainly I think there are things you could point to if you really wanted to, whether it's going to satisfy the likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg, I'm doubtful.
That's the thing, isn't it, Martin, that actually there are probably a hardcore of these Tory Brexiteers where it is a personal opposition now and to the Prime Minister, to her strategy, and who will probably, maybe people who resigned from the cabinet, for example, and they may never back anything.
Well, there's however many it was, 118 of them who voted less than a month, well, just about a month ago, you know, that she should no longer be the leader of the Conservative Party. And with her amazing resilience and ability to act as though, you know, the crisis is just a kind of irrelevance to her continuation in office, she's seen them off in the short term. you can't tell me that those 118 have all suddenly decided they were wrong. They don't think that. They never thought that in the first place. If you actually look at the... When Theresa May became leader of the Tory party, she got 199 votes from Tory MPs. When she survived a leadership challenge in December, she got 200 votes. In other words, you know, the party is divided. It's actually divided. It is divided. These people don't like her. They don't like what she stands for. They are opposed to it. And if these things mean anything, they are not going to agree to the kind of thing that she brings back. Legally binding is the key phrase, I think.
Changing the Attorney General's legal advice, a few of them have said.
Yeah, well, that's a further important factor in it. But I just think there is no real serious prospect of the whole existing withdrawal agreement being rewritten. What there is possibly some prospect of, if they can find a way of doing it, is what you've just been hearing about, which is some kind of legally binding addendum that... It's either an addendum or it's in parallel. I mean, these words kind of matter. But in the end, I don't think that the Jacob Rees-Moggs of this world are going to accept that because of everything.
And Polly, she's got to now try and make up for perhaps those people who are never going to move with votes from Labour. And she's got a list now of sort of 25 of them who might, we hear that they might get money for their constituencies, they might... Melanie Onn, who's a shadow frontbencher, one of those who abstained, MP for Grimsby. She had a bill about protecting workers' rights, which was talked out by the Tories. Maybe we'll see that resurrected. Will it work?
It's hard to know. Those 25 certainly alarmed a lot of people in Labour that there were so many. They thought it would just be the old Eurosceptic diehards and one or two others. 25 is a large number. I don't think she can get any more than that. I don't think she has a chance of getting more than that. And it's possible that some of those will stand back. I mean, there are serious people like Jim McMahon, ex-leader of Oldham, very surprising to see there, who know what the effect of no deal would be. And I think that there is no chance whatever of making any deal with Labour in a bigger sense. The only interest Labour has is in making sure that no plan of hers succeeds. Brexit belongs to the Tories, their disastrous idea. They've brought us to this point. There is no reason why Labour should help out in any way at all beyond the one crucial thing of making sure that no deal doesn't happen.
Okay, thanks everyone. Now, how did we get to this point? Well, economics historian Kevin O'Rourke has written a book that attempts to put Brexit into a historical perspective. A Short History of Brexit covers why the UK was sceptical for so long about the EEC, Brentry in 1973, the 1975 referendum, the construction of the single market in the 80s and 90s, all the way up to the challenges we face today. Heather Stewart sat down with Kevin and they began by talking about the formation of the single market.
So it's a reaction to the 1930s, if you like. And the 1930s tells us several things. It tells us that you can't have protectionism in Europe. That's too costly. So we need a free trade bloc. But the 1930s also tells us that you can't just leave everything to the market, that you need welfare states, that you need mixed economies, that you need to avoid regulatory races to the bottom. And so the EEC was not only about trade, it was also about a common rule book that would anchor the social democracies that were being born in the late 1940s. And so that's where some of these rules
about
labour...
about things about labour standards.
Labour standards, environment standards, all that kind of stuff. You know, that's deeply written into the DNA of the EEC and EU. If you look at the original Treaty of Rome, there's all this stuff in there, for example, about equal pay for men and women. Not because there were a bunch of feminists, you know, but because the French had theoretically equal pay for men and women. The Belgians, the Germans didn't. And so the French were worried that this would put them at a competitive disadvantage.
They didn't want to be undercut.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you want to do this with us? Well, then we're going to have the same standards and stuff in there about holidays, paid holidays. There was a protocol the French got in at the last moment about overtime. hours and working weeks and so on, because the Germans had a longer working week than the French. Again, the French, you know, they're trying to make life better for their workers, but they don't want to be undercut by people who have a 48-hour week as opposed to a 40-hour week. So this stuff is deeply baked into the thing right from the beginning. And so, you know, the notion that you could have some sort of a deregulatory bonfire, a new Singapore on Thames, and that you'd just be able to then trade freely with the rest of Europe, that again is would transgress one of Europe's most fundamental red lines. You know, so once you understand the history, you know, you can see where the Europeans are coming from. And I guess that's also true for, you know, the Irish border issue. I mean, there's obviously an Irish history there that's relevant.
It should have been obvious from very early on, shouldn't it, that the Irish question, as it were, was going to come to sort of shape the Brexit debate.
Yeah, and I mean, there were former prime ministers and well-meaning academics and so on, and ex-senior civil servants who said, you know, hang on a second, this is a bit dangerous. But I think it's fair to say that there wasn't a lot about this in the 2016 referendum.
No, I remember one campaign event, I think, with former prime ministers about it.
Yeah, if you look at Tim Shipman's All Out War, which is a brilliant account of what actually happened, and you go to the index, you won't find a single mention of either Ireland or Northern Ireland in the index. And that's not a criticism of his book. I think it's an accurate reflection of the campaign that we went through. And yet this has been the central problem ever since, which makes sense if you look at Irish history and why we don't want a border to return and so on. But what I don't think the British ever really understood was, and never really accepted, and still finds hard to accept, actually, is that Europe would back Ireland on this issue. Because after all, Ireland is a very small country. You know, after all, a no-deal Brexit is in nobody's economic interests, you know. So why on earth would you risk a no-deal Brexit, you know, to prop up the interests of a country with 4.5 million people? 6 million if you include the people in Northern Ireland. And I guess the point is that, you know, for the Europeans, the EU really isn't just about the money, you know, and that's maybe the most fundamental mutual.
It's about solidarity.
It's a political project. It's a peace project. Those things aren't just cliches. You know, they really aren't just cliches. If you go to an Armistice Day celebration in France, you know, Monsieur or Madame le Maire will always read out a speech written for the occasion by the minister of this or that. And there'll nearly always be some mention of how this tragedy of the Great War shows why Europe is needed. That also is deeply ingrained in their DNA. It's not just cynical palaver. They really believe it. And what that meant is that when Irish diplomats started going around Europe and saying to their colleagues, you know, this is really serious, you're putting the peace process at risk, you need to back us up on this, you know, they were actually pushing on open doors.
Why has Britain never been able to fully partake of that sense of kind of, you know, that we need to uphold this solidarity, or we need to be willing to pool our sovereignty in order to avoid that kind of situation arising again?
Well, you know, I guess the first thing that I'd say, and I would always make this point when talking to a French audience, is that my sense is now, as an outsider who works in Britain, is that among the most fervent pro-Europeans in Europe today are actually these hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Brits who realised on June 24, 2016, that actually being European was not just something that was useful practically, but that it actually was a part of their identity.
And again, that was not talked about in the campaign either. It was all about the money and the sort of, as you said,
it was all about the money, you know. But it turns out not to be, you know. And I think in a sort of paradoxical way, these people who are now going on demos and so on and waving European flags, I think they probably feel more profoundly European than I would say many French people or many Germans, because when you have it and it's not an issue, you just take it for granted. I think that's just as true in other European countries.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone waving a European flag in Britain before that.
Yeah, so you know, there are two Britons there, and one of those Britons feels very, very deeply European. I think they completely get it, and it's actually quite moving in a way. Why was this not more widespread earlier on? I mean, I'm sure it has got to do with Britain's history. And I don't think it is just imperial nostalgia. You know, I think that there were, you know, different configurations of interests. You know, there was this link with the Commonwealth that was very, very important well into the 1960s, you know, in terms of economics, but also in terms of sentiment. You know, I mean, and they were the countries. Yeah, Britain didn't stand alone. You know, in 1940, they had the Commonwealth standing with them. And that turned out to be crucially important. And it was important as well in World War One. You know, ultimately, those two world wars were won with the resources of, well, Russia in the second case. But in both cases, the New World, you know, the colonies, the Commonwealth on the one hand, and the USA on the other, and there are also many English people who had cousins and grannies.
Yeah, we had migration from those countries
all that
later.
Stuff. So it's completely understandable, you know. So that's what I would be wanting to say to continentals, is that these split loyalties in Britain that you saw historically are completely understandable, but unfortunately, in life, sometimes you have to make choices, you know, and. There was a point in the 40s, 50s where people thought they wouldn't have to make a choice between the empire and Europe. You know, they could fashion a Europe that would allow Britain to retain preferential trade links with the Commonwealth.
Talk to us a bit more about that, because that has echoes, doesn't it, down to the sort of perceptions today about what we would be able to achieve.
Yeah, so, I mean, somebody like Churchill with his, you know, famous phrase about the three interlocking circles and so on, he clearly didn't think that in principle there ought to be a conflict between taking a leading position in Europe and a leading position in the Commonwealth and being America's favourite interlocutor at this side of the Atlantic. And so people like him, they're very keen on European integration, but they want it to be sort of loose. You know, they don't want supranational structures that would give rise to majority voting that might mean that you might at some stage have to accept something that you didn't yourself want. You know, so that's a very basic distinction, you know, between supranationalism and the voluntary cooperation of independent and sovereign states.
This is the idea of a sort of federal Europe, is the phrase that often gets used.
It's federal, but federal not as we know it today, you know.
Yeah.
So they were more in favour of maybe a Europe that might have operated a little bit like the Commonwealth operated in those days. So, you know, they get together and they decide things. And I mean, in the interwar period, they're sometimes deciding real stuff, you know, with real economic meat, but it's all on the basis of...
It's on the basis of
sort of consensus. And of course, conveniently, Britain had a particularly influential role within that organisation. So, you know, why couldn't you do it that way in Europe as well? That made sense, I'm sure, from their point of view. They were in favour of a free trade area within Europe, but they were not in favour of a customs union. And that's a distinction that is still misunderstood, but it turns out to be completely crucial, not just for the history, but for where we are today.
And what was the rationale for that at the time?
So the difference between a free trade area and a customs union, that it's an easy one to understand, but you have to know it, is a free trade area involves, you know, say Britain and France agreeing not to put tariffs on each other's goods, right? So the Brits won't put tariffs on imports of French lamb and vice versa. You know, but the French in this scenario will have agreed not to put tariffs on imports of British lamb. They haven't necessarily agreed not to put tariffs on imports of Australian lamb. That's a lot cheaper, right? And so if you only have a free trade area, you're going to have French border inspectors checking that the lamb that's coming in from across the channel is actually British and not Australian.
And they can then go around and strike lots of trade deals with other
exactly.
deals with other
countries. Exactly. And so that's the cost is you have to have these border inspections. The benefit is you can all go off and do your own trade deals. So the Brits, pretty obviously now, once you think about it, were in favour of a free trade arrangement with Europe, because they could then have maintained their existing preferential trade deals with the Commonwealth. So they could have had their cake and eaten it. And so it's a sort of a shock to the system when the Continentals go for a customs union, you know, and they go for a customs union precisely because, well, for two reasons. Precisely because, first of all, they want to avoid border inspections to verify where stuff comes from. But also they realise that, you know, if they all have the same tariff policy, they're going to have greater bargaining power vis-a-vis the rest of the world when they go out and they strike trade deals, you know. And they want to avoid border controls to check rules of origin. I suppose not just because those border controls are costly, but also, you know, for political reasons. But once they make that choice, then Britain is stuck. It has to choose. You know, it can't be a member of the European Customs Union and have preferential trade deals with the Commonwealth. So they're in a real bind, you know. And, you know, as you know, Macmillan eventually decides he's going to go for Europe. But even then, there are rumblings on the Conservative backbenches among people then who in particular would have been worried about turning their back on the Commonwealth. So you can sort of see where the British are coming from. But it does mean that they have a long, long history of not wanting to make choices that, you know, regrettably or not, they do actually have to make.
And
that's where
Theresa May used to say, do you want to, are you going to be in the customs or not? It's not a customs union or not. And she would say it's not necessarily a binary choice. Isn't it extraordinary that we've now had two and a whatever half years since the referendum result, and we are butting our heads up against exactly that choice, right? Between some kind of free trade area and a customs union.
Yeah. You can either have frictionless trade with Europe. That will mean that, for example, industries dependent on supply chains continue to operate as they have been doing. You can either have that, or you can have your own independent trade policy. You can't have both, and that's a choice that they find it impossible to make. But it's maybe not surprising that Ireland is where the issue came to the head, because Ireland is where the internal contradictions of the hard Brexiteer position end up having to be resolved, because if you want to avoid a border there, it's not enough to say let's turn a blind eye to a bit of smuggling, which seems to have been, you know, one of their very clever ideas for avoiding a border. You do actually need to sign on to common customs arrangements and common single market rules. So given that Britain was always going to face this choice, you know, it was going to have to be faced somewhere, and it probably isn't that surprising ex post that Ireland was the place
where it's almost, it's kind of the physical manifestation of that choice in a way.
Exactly so.
And where do you think we'll end up? Where will we end up? What will happen next?
I have absolutely no idea.
and luckily for you, it's not your job to try and guess.
There you go.
Kevin O'Rourke there, talking to Heather Stewart. And we'll be back after this.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now, on Tuesday, Fiona Onasanya, the MP for Peterborough and a former Labour whip, was given a 3-month jail sentence for lying to avoid a speeding ticket. She's expected to try and remain in office, despite calls to stand down from both Labour and the Conservatives, and will continue to be paid while in prison. The Guardian's Rajiv Sayal was at the Old Bailey to hear the verdict, and I spoke to him earlier. Rajiv, this doesn't happen very often. Onasanya is the first sitting MP to be jailed since Labour MP Terry Fields in 1991 for failing to pay the poll tax. So tell us a little bit about the case.
Well, Fiona Onasanya kind of came from nowhere when she won the 2017 general election, beating the Brexiteer Stuart Jackson by 700 odd votes. And people really didn't know where she had come from, but it turned out that she was a solicitor who had become a councillor about 5 years earlier in Cambridge and had been fast-tracked into a position that no one thought she would really win, and a seat that no one thought Labour would win. And then she did win it. It was a shock, and she found herself in Parliament. Now, in 2017, shortly after she had been elected, her car was photographed driving along a Cambridge A road, and it was caught driving at 41 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone. A letter was sent to her home, and it was returned saying that her lodger, a Russian man, had been driving the car. And this then sparked a whole series of events which led to a court case and an allegation of perverting the course of justice, which is a very serious allegation. So from quite a minor and small allegation, who hasn't broken the speed limit at some point, she found herself as a politician at the centre of quite a legal storm which could and did ruin her career as a politician and her career as a solicitor. She's also a trained solicitor.
How did she let it escalate like this? I mean, you were in court, and what could have been just a sort of small offence sort of escalated into this big drama? Did you get any sense of what it was that led that happen?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting, and it's quite a sad reflection on the way in which politics and the British political system works, because it turned out that she had arrived at Parliament, had no staff, had frankly very little idea about how MPs work, because she didn't really know that many. She was out of her depth, and she was in a panic. She was literally working in a corridor in Westminster and was getting thousands of emails every week asking for her help from constituents. And at that time, she was caught speeding. Now, The allegation was that she had colluded with her brother, Festus, who's a year younger than her. She's 35, he's 34, in order to dispose of this and other speeding offences that he'd been involved in. So the allegation from the prosecution was really that she had been involved in a conspiracy to hide the fact that she should have had 3 points on her licence. But in the background, there's really a big question about the way in which new MPs are treated and helped by the political establishment, and whether or not they're pretty much abandoned. And I'd say in her case, the judge ruled that she was pretty much abandoned by the parliamentary authorities, that this was a factor in her behaviour.
And Labour have certainly, you know, seem to have abandoned her now. She's now an independent, yes, MP. She's been told by them that she should quit, but she doesn't seem to. She seemed determined not to quit. And why is that?
Her barrister said in court, Christine Agnew, that she had clung on to her job because it was literally her only source of income. And that has prompted quite an outcry. You've seen it on the front of several tabloids, on the front of several national newspapers, that there's an awful lot of pressure which is built upon her to stand down. Personally, I've always agreed that, you know, if a politician is caught committing a criminal offence, I've always thought that, yes, they should stand down. But at the same time, I do think it's a little rich to say that if we're going to try and encourage people who have non-political backgrounds and really and who want to bring those different life experiences to the job, then actually you can't expect them to always understand the ins and outs, and also you can't expect them to have any money or help in the background to pay things such as everyday living expenses or help them out once they get sent to prison. So I feel a certain amount of a smidgen of sympathy for her on that point.
How can she actually be removed as an MP? Her constituents can vote for her to be removed as an MP, right?
Yes. Right now, it's going to be quite difficult. The Labour Party have kicked her out. If she had received a sentence of 12 months or more, she could have been kicked out immediately, according to parliamentary rules. Because she's received a sentence of less than 12 months, it means that she can face a recall petition. Now, there are plenty of people, including the Labour and the Tory parties, that are raring to go to get rid of her. But they can't do that until the appeal process has gone through the courts. And she, quite cannily, you might think, lodged an appeal in the new year, which means that she can now go to jail and rest assured that during that period she can't be removed from office, because we all have to wait for that appeal process to take its course, and it usually takes between 4 and 6 months.
What do you reckon the chances are of, you know, people trying to... There have been MPs, Ian Paisley in Northern Ireland, where there's a bit of recall petition,
yes,
launched against him, and it wasn't successful.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are if kind of both sides, if both Labour and the Conservatives are both kind of trying to get people to sign this petition?
I think it's going to be difficult, but it's doable. The reason I think it's going to be difficult is because you have to convince 7,000 people within that constituency. It's 10% of a constituency. You have to persuade 7,000 people to step out of their homes, go to a particular polling booth, and there will be 5 or 6 or 7 selected in each constituency, and put a cross on a piece of paper which says, yes, I'd like to recall my MP. Now, that's quite a difficult thing to do, particularly when there are restrictions on how you can campaign for that. And we haven't seen it done because obviously the recall legislation came in 2015. It's only been tested once in Ian Paisley's case and it failed. But I think in this case, because it's someone who's been sent to jail, you have to say that you would expect that there would be enough people coming forward. But who knows? I mean, it's never been tested, so we'll see. It'll be an interesting one.
Rajiv Sahel there. So, I mean, at the moment, Polly and Martin, it looks like Fiona Anasanya is planning to stay on as long as she can, although there's obviously the possibility of this recall petition. Peterborough's a very tricky seat, isn't it, for Labour? It'll be something the Tories would be keen to get.
If you were trying to think of a seat in the whole of Britain that is a classic marginal, it is Peterborough. I mean, throughout my life, Peterborough has been a marginal. There was one famous general election, I can't remember offhand which year it was, when I think the winning side won by 3. And it's that kind of seat. And, you know, the Tories held it until very recently. Fiona Anisanya won it by a few hundred votes. It was a very heavily Leave seat. And so it's all set up for this to be a very important by-election, as everybody on both sides of the aisle completely sees.
It's the quintessential battleground for Brexit. There it is, east of England, large Eastern European population moving in there. A lot of the, you know, anti-immigration sentiment was about places like Peterborough that genuinely have seen lots of immigrants, though of course a lot of the Leave seats have never seen an immigrant. But so it is, you know, it will be unbelievably hard fought on both sides. It will be very emblematic. If they do manage to reject her, which it sounds as if they will, then it'll be really one of the most exciting and frightening by-elections of our time.
And of course, there have been very few by-elections recently because MPs are healthier and younger. They don't die. And because there's a hung parliament, you can't afford to...
People have got to cling on.
give people baubles to go and, you know, go off and govern New South Wales or whatever they used to do, you know, become head of this or that. You know, so everybody's... there haven't been that many by-elections in recent years. So it's a really it's going to be a really, really high visibility test.
And both sides really could do with an extra person, couldn't they? If Theresa May could certainly do with a sort of extra Tory loyalist, and Labour could also do with one as well.
I mean, the candidate selection is going to be absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's going to be like those by-elections in the 1980s, you know, where absolutely the whole political world descends on one place and works it to death, is obsessed with the minutiae of what's going on. You know, if you're old enough to remember the 1980s, you will remember that by-elections were a real circus for a period. We've completely gone out of that, but this is the circus will be back in town.
And we shall all be there.
Thanks very much, all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Polly Toynbee, Martin Kettle, Aarti Shankar, Kevin O'Rourke and Rajiv Sahel. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.